say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you. I say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Robert Yoon here in the studio with me. Rob, welcome.
It's great to be here. Lovely studio you have here.
Yeah, you're no stranger to the studio. You're here on a Sunday evening for the J Word, your program, your new public affairs show.
Yes, Sundays at 7.
And not so new. It's been going since the beginning of
it launched
the semester.
Yeah, it launched mid-September, and last fall it was on every other Sunday, and then this year, starting in January, it's been every Sunday, so we kicked it up a notch.
Ooh, how's that going, the pacing?
You got to feed the beast.
You do.
Each Sunday just keeps come barreling at you.
So on that note, thank you for being part of feeding the beast that is Leland Writers and being game for talking about your work on today's program.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm quite honored.
Well, the honor's all mine, Stephanie's, and listeners out there, right? Okay. So before we go further, start with your short bio. Robert Yoon is a political journalist and a Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan. He's also the host of the J Word, WCBN's new public affairs program about journalism and current events. For 17 years, Yoon served as director of political research at CNN, where he earned 2 Emmys and a Peabody Award for his contributions to the network's election coverage. He is also a contributor and analyst for Inside Elections, a nonpartisan political newsletter. Mediaite named him as one of the most influential people in the news media in 2016. Yoon has degrees from Harvard University and the University of Michigan, where he wrote for The Daily. The Michigan Daily.
I know it well.
And was a peer tutor.
I was a peer tutor here at the university. Back then it was called the English Composition Board. Now it's the Sweetland Center for Writing, I believe.
Yeah. And Peer Tutoring Center. And was it in Angel Hall when you were there?
Well, we had class. So we actually had a peer tutoring training class, and that, I don't remember where the classroom was, but it was about 15 of us who met with one of the ECB instructors. So we learned
Was it George Cooper by any chance?
No, her name was Helen Isaacson.
Oh. Okay.
Did you know her?
No.
Lovely lady. So they taught us, she and, you know, they had other guest instructors, and we observed other more experienced tutors, and we just learned the intricacies of you know, looking over people's writing and then giving them feedback, and you know, how to be delicate and how to be constructive, but also, you know, trying to be helpful and not wasting their time and actually trying to give them, you know, good information to shape their writing.
And Sweetland still does that. There's still classes that folks take, and then they're part of the center and have the. But
great.
Does this was this like one of the beginning parts of you as a writer? Was this formative for you, Rob?
I had always been interested in writing since I was young, and then in high school was when I guess actually started to do something about it. I worked on the high school newspaper, and a lot of that was mainly writing kind of dry, you know, newsy style articles about, you know, what's, you know, changes in the lunch menu or meet the new student teacher. But as I guess got more experience, I was able to do what I really liked, which was write a humor column, which was a lot of fun. I recently went back and you know, started finding the old clips from my high school paper, and they're horrible. They're all horrible.
What was the high school paper called, Rob?
It was called, so I went to Rockville High School in Rockville, Maryland. The paper was called The Rampage, which was a bit of a pun because the the mascot for the Rockville High School was the Rams. So it was the Ram page.
And there's a page, and then you're on a Ram page.
It works on so many levels.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And so you worked into humor writing there because Dave Barry was a hero of yours when you were young.
Yes, I was a huge...
Well, not that you're not young now, Rob. I mean, in your younger days.
Thank you very much. When I was even younger.
Yes.
Amazing. Right. So I was a huge fan of Dave Barry. He still is a syndicated humor columnist, and his columns would appear every Sunday in the Washington Post, in the very last page of the Washington Post magazine. So every Sunday I would go to the coupon insert and like tear open the coupon insert, pull out the magazine, and then read the last page of the Washington Post magazine to read Dave Barry's column. And then I would rip it out and then I would save it. So I have this huge
scrapbook.
Well, it's not even a scrapbook. It's just more of like a scrap pile.
A scrap pile.
But I still have it. It's somewhere in my parents' house, hidden away so they don't throw it out. But it's just a huge stack of his old writings.
Did you ever write to him to tell him this or talk with him about it?
Well, I did meet him on two occasions. He came for a book signing in Washington, D.C. when I was in high school. And so I went and then I took my book and went to get it signed. And then actually just a few years ago, he was also in D.C. again doing a book signing, this time at the National Press Club. At this point, I was a full-fledged adult. And so I went and... this time, I don't remember if I got his book or what, but I just went and chatted with him a little bit and got his picture. I took the picture that we had taken back when I was in high school, and he was probably as flattered as he was creeped out.
I love that. And then did you take another picture with him, kind of recreating
the
scene?
I marked my calendar, you know, 15 years from now. I'm going to track him down wherever he is right. And hold up both pictures.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, but he
was... Or even if it's like a sight.
Yeah.
Just... I mean, just to be grim, I guess. So. Dave Barry, you keep going. You keep going.
Right, right. Yeah, maybe we'll be buried next to each other. Just keep it going.
If you don't mind sharing one or both of those photos with me, Rob, I'd love to put it on the Living Writers Instagram.
Oh, my. Okay. All right. I'll have to dig those up.
As if they're not easily accessible to you right now.
Right. They're not hanging above my fireplace.
Well, okay. So there's so many things to ask you right now. Maybe a quick connect back to Michigan, because you came here then as an undergrad. So maybe you started writing, you wrote for the high school newspaper, you got a humor column, then you came here and you kept writing for the Michigan Daily.
Yes. So I worked on the high school paper. I wrote this humor column, and it was definitely a labor of love. And heavy on the labor. And I at that point, I had written papers for school and, you know, written the news articles, but it was really those columns where I was expressing my creativity, where it was a lot of work. And, I would just kind of, a lot of my, I guess, habits as a writer developed during that time, where I just kind of will pace around the room and just think about different things and get distracted. And then, you know, every now and then we'll go back to my computer or to my notepad at the time, and then scribble out a few lines and then just kind of watch TV. And, you know, there was a funny tweet that I saw not too long ago where someone said a great idea for a business would be a cleaning company staffed just by writers on deadline, just because like they're always looking
still
for
be
distractions.
Ready. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I could do that.
That's true.
So, but yeah, then in college, I actually didn't write for the paper right away. It was a friend of mine, junior year, who had worked on the paper, and we were RAs together, and she knew that I liked to write, and at the time, the RAs had this I guess the equivalent of a message board back then, where we just communicated about either, you know, RA stuff or just personal stuff, like a community messaging site. And based on my posts, she thought that I might be good at writing theater reviews, reviewing plays. So she asked me, and I said, okay, sure, even though I didn't really have much of a theater background. But it was perfect for me because I wasn't quite ready to devote the 24/7 that a lot of the hardworking Michigan Daily students devote to the paper. So this way I was able to write, an article a week maybe, or, when I could fit it in. And it also allowed me to be a little creative. It wasn't just, straight academic writing or news writing. And I got to see some free plays.
Always a bonus.
Yeah.
Support the arts.
Right. And then that's actually how the tutoring thing came along also, because one of our RA supervisors, I guess also on the basis of those bulletin board posts, asked if I'd be interested in being a writing tutor.
So your writing, was that engaging as people were looking at the board? Rob, that's a great sign, isn't it?
I guess so. I mean, it was very flattering, and I wish I... It was this old system called MTS, the Michigan Terminal System, which I'm sure went away many years ago. Yeah. But and then, each class would set up an MTS site and they would have class discussions for, whatever their topics were. But for the our RA staff would have one. We talked about, whatever, there were announcements or whatever issues, but then there would just be these random, someone would start a topic about, movie spoilers. And so, so people just type Rosebud and Rosebud was a sled and all that.
Oh no. So cruel.
Yeah, exactly. It was horrible. But it was kind of like an early form of social media where people just got these, this outlet for their, 5 second creative bursts.
Right. And it was a place for your voice, like an outlet for your voice.
Yeah, I do remember it being a fun outlet. Yeah.
So then senior year, did it change for you here, like with the newspaper, or did you kind of keep it still? Because now I'm wondering, what was your route to becoming the 17 years
to being on Living Writers?
To be why are you here, Rob?
It was a direct path.
I'm so glad. What took you so long? It was a direct path. You should have been here. But then you were 17 years as director of political research, which involved a ton of writing. You've written speeches for Al Gore.
Yes.
You
so
write all the time, it seems.
Right. Well, right. So the type of writing I liked the most was, something where I could be more creative. But I guess... along the way, I had also figured out that I could also write kind of clearly in a more straight, sober way, I guess, for academic writing and news writing and so forth. And so, eventually, I went to grad school. And while I was in grad school, everyone had to, we're all looking for internships. So I ended up getting an internship at the White House, and I was assigned to Al Gore's speechwriting office, which at the time was kind of a joke in itself because Al Gore was not really known to be a great orator.
I mean, especially now it makes me want to go back and see if I can hear any jokes that you may have woven into.
Right. Well, at the time, Al Gore was always kind of made fun of for being wooden and artificial and just very awkward. And one of his famous gaffes at the time was this claim where he essentially suggested that he had invented the internet.
Oh, right.
And people had just made fun of him for it. So then I, when I was there, I suggested to the speechwriter that this line where he said, Al Gore would say, I never said I invented the internet. I said I invented the intertube, which I thought was hilarious. But they never used it.
They didn't.
And what happened to Al Gore? Where is he now?
I know.
That line could have saved him.
Amen, Rob.
Amen.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to find out more of what could have saved Al Gore, even ourselves. Today on the program, Robert Yoon is here. You've got Living Writers. We've got Stephanie behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Today on the program, Robert Yoon is here. Thanks for choosing the songs for today's program, Rob.
Thank you for letting me. I love to share my musical tastes with the world.
And so what was the inspiration for this one?
So that was the D-Light theme from D-Light, which was a bit of a one-hit wonder band from the 90s. But their big claim to fame song was Groove Is in the Heart. Was their biggest hit. But
now that's going to be in all our heads too.
Yes.
Thanks,
which
Rob.
Is also also a great song. But when I was a kid, my aunt listened to oldies music, which at the time was like 50s and 60s. And so I started listening to it also. So I thought, "Oh, so this is 60s music. This is 50s music." And I kind of got a flavor of what music from a particular decade sounded like. But then on the cusp of the 90s, you know, it's the late 80s. And I'm thinking, so what is 90s music going to be like? So D-Light was the very first album I bought in the 1990s. So I was like, oh, so this is what 90s music is like.
90s.
But I loved it. And, you know, I brought it to college with me. And it's one of a handful of albums that I've had where I can just listen to the whole album from beginning to end. And this is the D-Light theme was the very first track on that album, and I just love the beat and it's a very different kind of album.
And it seems like it also is music can bring you back to that moment, those memories, that time. So easily.
Yes, sometimes for good, sometimes sometimes for ill.
Right. Well, with D-Light, I can't imagine that it could ever be
right.
No. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about Al Gore and the inner tube.
Yes, and the inner tube. The line that could have won him the White House. I was an intern, basically, in the White House, assigned to the Al Gore's speechwriting office. And I was given a surprising amount of responsibility in that position. A lot of interns were answering phones or opening mail or doing whatever. But I was also a little bit older as a graduate student. A lot of the other interns were, you know, college students. But they actually let me write, after an initial period, they actually started to let me write speeches. And that was a very specific type. It was such a weird experience writing speeches at all, because a lot of people, you just don't really write speeches ever, and then to write speeches for other people to give was just a weird experience. But
what was it like writing, because you're writing something but it's not your voice,
right? And so you have to kind of know the context of what the event is and who the person is you're writing for, in this case the Vice President of the United States, and whatever larger political context there might be. I mean, I never had to write anything of huge import. You know, the vice president ends up doing, any vice president ends up doing all sorts of ceremonial events, and they need to have something to say, and someone has to write it. And then, so I guess to indicate just how important this event is, you know, someone says, oh, well, let the intern do it. And so that was me. So there was one event where there was a swearing-in ceremony for this government agency called the Export-Import Bank, which in itself sounds very exciting. So they were swearing in the new head of the Export-Import Bank, a woman named Jackie Clegg, and she was the wife of, or she might have been the girlfriend at the time of a senator, Chris Dodd, who's a longtime Democratic senator. So she was being sworn into this position, and I wrote Al Gore administered the oath of office to the new XM chairman, and I wrote those remarks. And because the event happened just upstairs from our office, my boss says, hey, the event's happening, why don't you go check it out? So I went upstairs, I saw the event, he pretty much read it word for word. I don't remember what I wrote. I don't really remember what I wrote. And then after the event, there was a little reception, and then Al Gore goes around shaking hands with people. And then, you know, he comes to me and shakes my hand. Nice to meet you. Thank you very much. And then goes on. And then I just thought, this is really weird. He has no idea that I wrote what he said.
Just came out of his mouth.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Did you also get to shake hands with Christopher Dodd too?
I might have. I don't quite recall the I don't keep track of my Christopher Dodd encounters as closely.
I know, sad but true. When I was in college, I was in Model Senate, and he was my assigned senator. So
oh.
I feel like some remote yes. kinship to him. But on with the story of Rob.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so then because I had that speech writing experience, when I was graduating from grad school. I had this bizarre thing on my resume that I'd written speeches for the vice president, and from that I ended up applying for a job on the Hill in the Senate, and then got a job as a speechwriter for a senator based really solely on the fact that I had done this internship. But yeah, speechwriting is just a very weird profession. For the things we talked about, you're not writing in your voice. You have to write in someone else's voice and then think about all the different external factors going on. So, you know, some group invites this person to speak to their group. So you have to find out what's
audience.
Important to this group. Exactly. And it's also very humbling, especially if you go to watch the event afterwards to see whether or not your words are actually getting used. And sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. And I've always, I think about President Trump's speechwriters, because just recently he was at an event in West Virginia, and he had a piece of paper in front of him, and he started saying something. He's like, yeah, you know what? This is boring. I'm not going to read this. So I just imagine somewhere. In the White House, there's this speechwriter's like, oh man,
like hours,
exactly.
Drive another stake through my as if there probably aren't other stakes already being driven. Right.
Yeah. So yeah, it's not for the faint of heart, I guess. Or you can't have you can't be too sensitive as a speechwriter.
And that can be hard for writers, right? Because like you said, you would, like when you were envisioning your columns in high school, and you'd be like pacing the floor and
right.
finding the pieces to put together.
Right.
But did this speech writing gig, then did you leverage that to go to CNN and become the director of political research? And
Yes. Well, so while I was at the Senate, I'd been there for a little less than 2 years, and then a job had opened up at CNN to work in the political unit covering the 2000 presidential campaign, the early stages of the 2000 presidential campaign. And at that point, I had always had a long interest in history and politics, so it was something I was definitely interested in. And then, I guess because of my experience working in politics and dealing with communication, the fact that I didn't have a specific, TV background wasn't an issue. So I got the job for what was supposed to be a 1-year position, doing research for the campaign coverage. And then, 1 year became, so the original deal was, all right, just make it to election day, and then you can have the rest of the year, you can job hunt and whatever, and you'll still be on the dime, but you can use that time to job hunt, but you won't really have to do anything. So then, but that obviously that was the election that didn't end with the Florida recount. So the election lasted 36 days, and by the time it was over, it was mid-December, my job was scheduled to end at the end of that month. And at that point, I didn't really care. I was so tired. I just wanted a break. But then, so that 1 year position ended up being, why don't you stay through the inauguration? You can help us with the inauguration. And so I stayed through the inauguration. And then they came back and says, well, we could use help with this project. Can you stay another month or so? So I just kept doing that for a couple months. And then it just morphed into 17 years before I knew it.
Yeah. Time is like that, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's really, yeah, it's definitely it's the longest place I've been at any institution, whether it's elementary school or college it was a long time.
I know that you're being very modest about it too, like how much is compacted within the accordion of that 17 years, like from what you started with to becoming the director of political research and then leaving, having to leave or wanting to leave rather.
Right. Well, so I was there for 17 years. After about 2 years was when I became the research director, although essentially that was because my boss had left for a different position within the company. And so I took over her research director responsibilities. Although the job leading up to that point was still rough. I was still doing roughly the same thing. So I was roughly doing the same thing for the full 17 years.
What does it mean then to be the director of political research at CNN? Like, what does that look like?
It's a lot of behind the scenes preparation for big events down the road, like for election nights or for, you know, the New Hampshire primary or the Democratic National Convention or the Republican National Convention. Or we have these big tentpole events that we cover at CNN. And so we know we're going to need, you know, we're going to need to know X, Y, and Z in order to cover this event. So I just would compile this information about candidate positions and what their backgrounds are and their biographies and things that they've said in the past, and just like this huge body of research about the candidates and so forth. And then I also dealt a lot with numbers, campaign finance, looking up campaign finance data, and I think a lot of journalists tend to be a lot of journalists have convinced themselves that they're not good at math. So, I'm not great at math, but I know I'm not scared of it. So, a lot of the numbers based stuff kind of fell to me, like with campaign finance or, looking at,
which is
Bureau
a big
of Labor
deal.
Statistic it's numbers.
Big... Oh yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So just anything that dealt with numbers, a lot of times came to me. And so in terms of writing, that can be very dry. I've written many really dull stories about, you know, such and such candidate has raised this amount and this candidate has raised this amount and whatever. But the challenge there is to find what the story is behind the numbers. And that's something where, you know, previous writing experience helps. You know, as a speechwriter, I was always trying to find the human angle to whatever policy we were talking about, or just telling the story of what's going on. And so that's always the challenge when you're dealing with what would otherwise be kind of dry material.
Because you were quite shy, you didn't really share the dry material with me in preparation for the program, but you did share three pieces that you wrote, a couple of profiles that are definitely not dry and completely voice driven, I was going to say. Well, but yeah, definitely damp.
Yes, it was very damp. That also kind of deals with this issue of taking a dry topic and making it interesting. So a couple of the pieces that I sent you were about delegates to the Democratic National Convention in 2012.
And there were going to be profiles about these people.
Right. Well, so part of my job in election years is to keep track of the delegate totals that each candidate has. And you hear about this during the primaries. It's this like weird system of how nominees are selected to be presidential nominees. And they have to, you know, run in the New Hampshire primary or the Iowa caucuses or whatever. And then after each event, you know, you see who won the event. But then you also hear, you know, Donald Trump won this many delegates and Ted Cruz won this many delegates. And it's just this complicated process that varies state by state and is very hard to understand. But and so we wrote a lot, and it ended up being a big story in 2016 about the delegate math and how many delegates does this person need to clinch the nomination and all that. But ultimately, every delegate is there. When you talk about delegates, you're talking about actual human beings, you know, people with mothers and fathers, or, you know, heartbeats.
Life stories.
Yeah, exactly. And so in 2012, I set out to try to, you know, meet who some of these people are. I mean, it's not that I had this idea by myself. Everyone was profiling delegates leading up to the convention. But, the trick is, you know, explaining that this process is about people. And a lot of those people have really interesting experiences. So
let's take a short break. Then when we come back, let's start with that. Today on the program, Robert Yoon is here. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
There must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue. If I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why. Understanding sometime, strong winds of promise that will blow away the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining on everyone, tell me why. Oh, why? Oh, why won't that sun?
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today on the program, Robert Yoon is here. Thanks for picking the songs.
My pleasure. That song was my favorite Elvis Presley song, called If I Can Dream. And it's, to me, it was one of his lesser known songs. I've always been a huge Elvis fan, but I didn't become aware of that song until not too long ago. And I really like it. It's very emotional, and it's not kind of like the lighter poppy hound dog type stuff from his earlier career. There's a lot of emotion behind it, and he actually wrote that. Well, he commissioned that song after Martin Luther King had been assassinated in 1968, which is relevant because we just observed the 50th anniversary of that a few days ago. And so the song is very much about a hope for the future where people can work together, and like this dream, like Martin Luther King's dream, you know, where a dream of a more hopeful future. So it's just a very powerful song that I love listening to.
It was wonderful to hear it then, the part of it that we could hear at the moment, Rob. When did it come into your life? Like, when did you, because it wasn't part of your aunt's collection.
Right. Well, it was because there was a Elvis album. So there was some resurgence in Elvis material maybe 10 years ago or so, or maybe a little longer. But so there was a CD released back when there were still CDs of Elvis's number one hits. And then at the end, they added a kind of a DJ mix of a lesser known song that at the time, I think it was Rubbernecking, which made the charts again after, you know, many years. So then that album was a big hit. And then a few years later, they released this other album called Elvis, the Number Two Hits, where it was...
This could go on and on,
yeah,
probably.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was on that second... It was on that Number Two Hit album where I... So I got that album. That song was on there. I'd never heard it before and just thought it was really cool. Oh, and then recently... Well, a couple years ago, I went to Graceland for the first time. And you have this audio headset, you know, to like a self-guided tour of Graceland. And so then when you and everything's programmed so that when you get to a certain location, a certain song comes on. So then towards the end of the tour, you actually come to Elvis's gravesite. Well, his gravesite and where his mother and father are buried and all that. So then as you're getting there is when If I Can Dream comes on, and such a soaring, emotional song. I thought it was a very perfect piece for that part of the tour.
Speaking of also first times and trips to places, we won't forget the profiles. We're going to get back to that. But with the fellowship, you most recently have just traveled to South Korea.
Yes. Yes. And a few minutes in North Korea.
Oh, damn. Can you tell us what that sure. story is? That sounds like a good one.
Right. So I'm, as you mentioned earlier, I'm here at the university this year as a Knight Wallace journalism fellow with about 18 other fellows, journalists from around the world. And we did basically what was a journalism tour of Korea. And we met with different news organizations there and talked to different organizations and got a sense of what the status of, you know, the media is in Korea. And then also learned, because it's in the news so much, we got different briefings about what's going on in current events. So, and I'm Korean American, but this was my first time ever visiting, you know, the country where my family comes from. So, I took an extra week ahead of the trip to do some sightseeing on my own and visit some relatives. And so it was a very meaningful trip. But part of our tour, our official journalism tour, was to go to the DMZ, which was the famous, the most famous image of the DMZ is where there are soldiers on both sides and they're just kind of staring into each other wearing like mirrored sunglasses and helmets and with very intimidating faces. So we went there, and there are these blue shacks, basically. They're little conference rooms that straddle the border between North and South Korea. And those rooms were set up so that they could have a neutral meeting place for when they meet, although they haven't used it for that purpose in years. But and now what basically it's used for is to take groups to show them the conference room. But once you're inside the conference room, you know, you can walk to the other end of the conference room and you're in North Korea, and you know, you look out the window, you're looking into North Korea. And but there's a very stern looking South Korean guard standing at the door so that you can't go into North Korea. But yeah, so I by crossing the crossing into the other end of the conference room, I was in North Korea for a little bit.
Who knew that could ever be something you could say, Rob?
Right, exactly. Like,
and
exactly.
That a conference room would have such pivotal sort of could play this role.
Yeah, it was quite an experience, especially with North Korea being in the news so much, and the border essentially is what it's about. You know, the Korean War ended with an armistice, not a peace treaty. So technically, you know, officially, official hostility has never ended. It's just that they have this what's basically a long ceasefire, but it all has to do with this this border. And so to go there and see it was quite surreal, you know, and the fact that, you know, you can just walk up to it and see it is all, we had special access to see it, but it was a very unusual experience for sure.
Would you mind saying more about the border as it is? Because in our country, with everything happening surrounding this idea of borders and making more of them, mm-hmm. when it feels like there should be fewer built
right.
borders.
Right. Well, yeah, there's been a lot of talk about borders and walls and all that. But so I was very surprised to see what the border was actually like between North and South Korea, where hostilities are so high. But, you know, at this spot where the conference rooms are, if I was a crazy person, I could have tried to sprint over into the North Korean side, and there was no physical barrier to stop me. Not that I would do that. But
were there people with guns?
Oh, there were people with guns, but you know, there wasn't
and reflective sunglasses.
Yes,
no, that was just
and helmets and all that. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So there's all that. You know, it's not encouraged that you do that for sure. But in terms of a physical barrier, you know, you're looking right. You're just like the distance between, you know, me and you might be the distance between, you know, you and North Korea without anything blocking you. It's just that you're not, you know, there are people to prevent you from doing that. And then we went to a different part of the border, just not too far away, where we were. It was kind of an overlook. So we had this overlook view into North Korea. There's actually this strange town in North Korea that you can see from the South Korean, this observation point. And it's an unoccupied town that our guide said was our guide refers to it as propaganda town, because they built it to give the impression that there's a vibrant community living there. But you know, I had my zoom lens on my camera, and you could see that the buildings were actually in very poor shape, and some of the windows had no glass and that type of thing.
So there was absolutely no people walking around.
Yeah,
in unoccupied
no people at all.
Town.
There was a giant North Korean flag, but no people in the town. So anyway, so we were at this observation point, and then ahead of us, I'm not good with distance, but not too far ahead of us, out of the woods, we see five soldiers just walking through the woods, and they were North Korean soldiers, and there was nothing separating us again. You know, there were every few feet there was a white post, but there was no fence, no wall, you know, not even a line to show where the border was, just these white posts planted along the way. And so there was a weird moment where these five armed North Korean soldiers and this group of journalists and their military guides, we were just staring at each other across the border.
What happened?
We just kind of stood there. We did, you know, just like when you run into a bear in the woods, you know, what do? We didn't make any sharp movements. I think I read in some survival guide, if you run into a mountain lion in the wild, you're supposed to unzip your jacket
to look
and
bigger,
then hold up your flap so you look bigger. So I thought, oh wait, is that for mountain lions or North Korean soldiers? But no, basically we just stood there and stared at each other.
And you didn't take any pictures.
Oh, actually I did. I had my, because I was taking pictures of propaganda town, I had my zoom lens on. So I actually took a few pictures of them, which in hindsight, I'm sure wasn't something that they enjoyed. And then eventually I think they were just wondering who is this group of 30 people standing at this, on this hill looking at our territory. So eventually they just walked off. But
so
I looked.
There was no verbal engagement.
No, okay. No. However, once it was over and we were back on the bus, I was looking at the photos that I had taken, and I had gotten these very, you know, I could see their faces, you know, from these photos. And then there was one photo where, and they were all the pictures all looked like they were looking directly at me, maybe because I had the camera. But there's one photo where, well, there are a couple photos where one of the soldiers had his hand on his gun, his holstered gun on his hip. Anyway, so I'm it's probably good I didn't notice that at the time as it was happening, but it was all over in just a minute or so. It wasn't a prolonged encounter, but our guide said it never happened before that he was aware of.
And how did a trip like this, because it sounds like it had profound personal reverberations, Rob, how would this trip, and what did you notice from the other Knight Wallace fellows also, how is it impacting their worldview, their roles, position as journalists?
Well, we learned...
And yours, I guess, most importantly.
Right. Well, we learned a lot about... It was very insightful about the state of journalism as a whole, just because that's the role of journalists, and journalism is something that's being debated, I think, around the world. And so there were a lot of aspects of the trip that really got to the core of journalism. You know, it was North Korea obviously is a very oppressive regime and routinely ranks at the bottom of the list of countries in terms of press freedoms. But South Korea, you know, up until, you know, not that long ago, also didn't have a great history of freedom of the press. And we learned about some of that history, which is kind of a you know, sad history. And, you know, the country has made progress since then. But for me, you know, it was very eye-opening to know that this you know, democracy, it's a young democracy, but still this democracy had really a difficult time dealing with freedom of the press and other things as well. You know, and things are better now, but it's really it was really eye opening to think that it doesn't take long for it wasn't that long ago that what we now consider an open democracy to have very repressive views towards the press.
And so how not to take that for granted in our own, in the U.S. as well.
Definitely.
Or across the worldscape and the press's role.
Right.
Across nations. And we'll take a short break and we'll come back. Today on the program, Robert Yoon is here. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
It's a shame the way you hurt me. It's a shame the way you mess around with your man. I'm sitting all alone by the telephone waiting for your call. When you don't call at all, it's a shame the way you mess around with your man. It's a shame the way you play with my emotions. It's a shame you mess around with the man. You're like a child at play on a sunny day. First you play with her and then you throw it away.
Why do you use me? Try to confuse me. How can you stand to be so cruel? Why don't you free me from this prison? For some time as a fool.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today on the program, Robert Yoon is here, political journalist, a Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan, also the host of The J Word, WCBN's new public affairs program about journalism and current events, and next year, visiting professor of journalism and communications. So you're going to be around another year.
I'll be back.
At least.
Can't bring myself to leave.
Yeah, I know. Michigan keeps bringing you back,
yes.
Okay? Yeah. Well, all the better for us. We're all the luckier.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
And thanks so much for talking today on the program with me, Rob. We need more time almost because there's so many things that we've managed to touch on here. And one thing to think about, let's think about like Robert Yoon, writer here, and maybe returning to the writing, like how do you tell the story behind the numbers? Because we touched on that earlier, how you were working at CNN with political research and the data and analysis. And there's so much in the public, in the media, in the public space, in the public eye, where stories grab our attention that perhaps shouldn't, that aren't that important. And stories like, what are the trends? What's happening with the numbers? Who are the delegates that are mm-hmm. representing us? These stories. Can you talk a little bit about your way as a writer within these pieces and how to engage
sure.
the audience?
Sure. So I deal a lot with I guess what can be dry information. You know, I download campaign finance data from the Federal Election Commission website and sort through that and figure out, you know, how much people have raised or what people are spending their money on and so forth.
That's important.
It's very important in terms of understanding what's happening in a presidential campaign.
Because it shows what people value, perhaps, or who they're being controlled by.
Right, right. And those are the types of stories that the numbers tell. But it's easy to just talk about the numbers and then move on and then not provide context by focusing just on the data, you're kind of missing the story, or you're missing the opportunity to engage people in terms of finding what you're doing as interesting as you do.
And what's the balance of being providing the facts and being objective, because this is what it's showing, versus being able to guide the reader to see what they need to see within the trends or within the facts?
Right. Well, I think with any type of reporting, with any type of journalism, is more effective if you can engage your reader into what you're reading. And a very traditional way of doing that is to tell a story. And, whatever it is you're covering, you know, there probably is some character that can tell your story for you. So you could do a story about, you know, job data, unemployment numbers, historic unemployment numbers, or job loss, or whatever, and tell a very dry story about, you know, here's what this statistic says and all that. Every month we get, there's a release from the Bureau of Labor Statistics where they release unemployment numbers, or, you know, jobs created or jobs lost in the past month. And so that can be, you can get into a trap where you're just reporting like, here's this number and here's how that compares to that number and whatever. But I think it's the challenge for journalists to take those numbers and then contextualize them for their audience. And, in a case with, you know, jobs numbers, you know, having the numbers is important to know what's going on, but you'd also want to find people who can explain that story for you. Like, here's an auto worker, you know, from Macomb County, who's been out of a job for this long, you know, like finding people, or finding a, it sounds crass to describe people this way, but finding a character in the story that describes what is happening in the story. And so that they can tell the story for you, or, you know, by telling their story, you know, you're actually explaining what is actually going on.
By telling their story, honestly, you're showing what's happening.
Right.
Right.
And, yeah. And I think that's much more compelling for the audience rather than, you know, actually downloading a data set.
Right.
You know, they can, you know, you can download the data set if you want for, you know, like extra explanation, but, you know, going out and finding these people, that's a way journalists can really make the story much more personal and understandable.
And so that's what you did with the piece when you were trying to make the idea of delegates, mm-hmm. and around the campaigns and the conventions, and you told the story of Commander Sherman.
Oh yes,
as a way to, you said this was a fun piece of writing for you too, Rob.
Yeah, that was probably the most fun I had writing. That was probably my favorite piece that I wrote at CNN. And again, you know, I was covering the delegate math, and then I decided, yeah, I was at the convention and was, you know, I decided, well, I just want to meet some of these people. And so I arranged a time to meet this gentleman named Stephen Sherman from California. He was California's oldest delegate at
91.
Age 91, a World War II veteran. And so I went to his hotel room and did a short interview with him for this piece I was going to write about him, although I didn't know what shape that piece would take. And then, you know, he was very interesting, very personable. He said that he'd left his driver's license at home. He didn't realize until he got to the airport, but he talked his way through the TSA and got on the plane and made it to the convention. So he's just a very charismatic 91-year-old vet.
And you show this character by telling, like, putting him in the narrative, the direct narrative.
Yes.
And also direct quoting him so that we actually, as readers, hear his voice and understand his story and why. Even like one of his like life's work was Doris Miller wanting Doris Miller to get Dory Miller to get a Medal of Honor.
Right. Yes. Yeah. He was a very so Commander Sherman, which is what he would like to be called. Yeah, it was just a very compelling person, and just in the course of me interviewing, I found out that one of his life's motivations was to try to lobby the president to award a Medal of Honor, which is the highest military honor that can be bestowed on a member of the military, to Doris Miller, who was one of the first heroes to emerge from World War II. He had manned an anti-aircraft gun during Pearl Harbor.
And his regular gig was as like a chef or a cook.
Right.
And he ran to do what was necessary.
Exactly. Yeah. He was a cook in the Navy. The attack happened and he got an anti-aircraft gun that he wasn't trained to operate. And then started fighting back. And I think he shot a couple planes down and ended up winning a Navy Cross, but not the Medal of Honor. And this is what Commander Sherman was trying to achieve for him.
And I'm not sure. It hasn't happened yet.
But... He didn't win a Medal of Honor. Commander Sherman actually passed away in 2015, sadly, and didn't realize his dream. But there are people who are still, hoping to get Dory Miller Medal of Honor.
Thank you for telling us about this today, too, Robert Yoon. And come back. This is part one of an ongoing conversation.
A mini-series.
Yes.
Okay.
And Sunday nights, The J Word on WCBN.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. You've been listening to Robert Yoon today on the program. We'll be back next week. Thanks.